From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
As the Supreme Court weighs racial preferences in college admissions, where did America's racial checkboxes come from in the first place? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, and we are joined today for this special edition of Potomac Watch by David Bernstein, a law professor at George Mason University and the author of the recent book Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. Welcome, Professor Bernstein. And I guess the best way to start is by answering the question posed at the top. People who've been following the Supreme Court case involving Harvard and the University of North Carolina, or frankly, anybody who's filled out a flu shot form or a mortgage application in recent years, has probably seen these six checkboxes. The general way it's phrased is, are you white, black, Asian, Native American, a Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander, and then a separate question for, are you Hispanic, yes or no? But Professor, these categories are not built into the fabric of the universe. So where did we get them?
We got them back in the 1970s. We had all this civil rights legislation passed. In the 1960s, we had all these great society programs, and the government was trying to keep track of the data for anti-discrimination purposes, the data for how the Great Society programs were working for various groups. And they found that different government agencies were reporting the data in completely different ways because they were using different definitions of which groups counted, how you define them. So, for example, what we now call Hispanic, some agencies were only counting Mexican-Americans, the largest group. Some were counting Mexicans and Cubans and Puerto Ricans. Some were counting Mexican, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, others. Some had Hispanos, some had Latinos, some had Spanish language households, some had Spanish surname. There were like 12 or 13 different ways to classify a group of people who had Spanish language descent. So the government said, okay, we need to regularize these. And they set up a commission to do so. And it was done very informally with very little publicity. It wasn't secret, but it wasn't that controversial because they said, we're only trying to gather this data mostly for civil rights enforcement purposes. And it's not supposed to be used for affirmative action or for medical purposes or for ethnological purposes, is just for statistical convenience. And it turned out, though, that once these criteria, these different classifications and their definitions have been officially adopted by the government, that they just became broadly adopted throughout society.
And they were adopted initially in 1977 by the Office of Management and Budget in what is now called Directive 15. And to your point about the limited nature of what the federal bureaucrats thought they were doing at the time, Directive 15 specifically says, quote, these classifications should not be interpreted as being scientific or anthropological in nature, nor should they be viewed as determinants of eligibility for participation in any federal program, unquote. And yet, Professor, it seems like they've gone everywhere, and something I know you're exercised about is that they are even in use in scientific studies and clinical trials.
Yeah, so this just goes to show how once the government starts in with something, it has unintended consequences that no one anticipated. So in the late 1990s, there was some concern that maybe scientific studies, first, you know, they're only being done on men, they should be done on women too. And if we're checking to make sure that women are included, well, why don't we check to make sure minorities are included? So if people have different genetic makeups, maybe drugs or vaccines or devices will work differently on them, which is plausible, but probably incorrect for the most part. But the Congress basically ordered the FDA and NIH to require everyone they regulate or fund to use some sort of classifications to make sure minorities are included. And FDA or NIH could have then said, okay, let's consult anthropologists, geneticists, sociologists, and so forth to figure out what actually makes sense from both a scientific point of view, whether there are some groups that may have, you know, different genetics that might affect medicine, or just from a sociological point of view, maybe some groups have particular lifestyles that might affect how these things work. Instead, they just took these classifications from the 1970s that were meant really for statistical purposes, primarily to enforce anti-discrimination laws, and just applied them to medical and scientific research, which is completely absurd. To give an example of the absurdity, Hispanics can come from any part of the world originally. They could be Asian, they could be from Europe, they could be indigenous, they could be of African descent. And even if you believe that genetics based on so-called race would have an effect on medicine and so forth, it would not. That's, you know, Hispanic isn't in any sense a race in that regard. It's saying people are Hispanic is like saying they're American. It doesn't give you that much of a clue as to their ultimate origins.
And the arbitrariness of these categories, I mean, that's a good segue into it, but that's one of the themes, it seems to me, of your book. And the Hispanic category includes people from Spain, immigrants to the U.S. from Spain, which is a developed EU country. It also includes people who have roots in indigenous communities in Mexico where they don't actually speak Spanish. Or to switch to another category, you know, the Philippines are an archipelago of islands, and yet people with roots in the Philippines are considered Asian. They're not considered Pacific Islander. And the important question also of where does Asia end, according to the federal government? It's at the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So people with Pakistani descent are considered Asian. People of Afghan descent are considered white in the U.S., according to the government. And one of the things that I think is notable about this is you have an argument and you have co-written a brief to the Supreme Court, a friend of the court brief to the Supreme Court in the Harvard case, making the case that this arbitrariness problem is not only a practical problem, but it's a legal problem. Why don't you lay that out?
Sure. So the legal problem comes in two different flavors here. First of all, under the Equal Protection Clause, which is the basis of the challenge to Harvard's admission plan, arbitrariness is sort of the hallmark of what makes something unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause. So that already raises red flags. Well, why? No one has ever articulated why, for affirmative action purposes, we use the statistical directive classifications in a crude manner. And what makes it especially a pressing point is that the only rationale the Supreme Court has accepted for diversity and for affirmative action, I should say, is diversity of the student body. And that's the argument that Harvard and UNC, the other defendant, are making, that we need racial diversity in our school for the benefit of all students. And the problem is, well, why is diversity as such, if you want students to be exposed to different cultures and so forth, why do we use these crude racial categories? Why do we say, Justice Alito asked at oral argument, why do we tell a kid from Afghanistan, hey, we don't want any more Afghans because we have enough Asians, because we have a lot of Chinese kids. What do Afghans and Chinese have in common? Just to accentuate how arbitrary and complicated these categories are, it turns out that Afghans are officially white, not Asian, but the point still remains. It doesn't really make any sense to take 60 or 65% of the world's population with extremely different cultures, appearances, food, you know, everything you can imagine, and say, well, for diversity purposes, you're all alike because the government arbitrarily decided to classify you all as Asian. So this is a real problem, I think, that the schools have here, is that if the purpose is diversity, shouldn't you rather take the first kid from Turkmenistan than the 1,001th kid from Mexico? But the first kid from Turkmenistan is just considered white and doesn't add to diversity, but taking in one extra kid from Mexico because he's Hispanic / Latino does officially add to diversity. It doesn't really make any sense from any sort of logical perspective.
And we actually have that clip of Justice Alito during the oral arguments. Listen to this. This is Justice Samuel Alito tangling with the North Carolina Solicitor General.
What is the justification for lumping together students whose families came from China with someone with students whose families came from Afghanistan? What do they have in common?
So I agree that would be a strange rule, and that is not the rule that this court has established.
Well, then why do you have them check a box and that I'm Asian? What do you learn from the mere checking of the box?
So we think that it depends on the individual circumstances of that person.
You don't need the boxes at all.
So I think that is not necessarily true on an individualized basis.
But to underline the point, he's asking about Afghans. And according to these Directive 15 categories, Afghans are not Asian. They are white, according to the federal government. So, I mean, that raises the question that does anybody check what people are putting down on their applications? And also, if the Supreme Court justices can't even keep all this straight, what about people who are filling in the applications who, correct me if I'm wrong, but are they even given the actual definitions of the categories under the checkboxes?
Yeah, that's one of the more bizarre things about how this all works, especially university admissions. I mean, when it comes to discrimination statistics, if a few people from Afghanistan put down the wrong classification, it doesn't really affect the overall statistics. But when you're looking at diversity, it should really matter if the applicants come from the places they say they come from and have the ethnicities they say they do. But first of all, like you suggested, My daughter happens to be applying to colleges now, so I'm very familiar with the Common App, which is the application everyone fills out. And it just basically gives you the categories. There are a few hints, like it says Hispanic, you know, include Spain. But for the Asian American classification, it doesn't actually tell you what the definition is. And you can easily imagine someone from Afghanistan or Iran or Armenia or some such, or who I should say whose family came from there originally, they're all Americans at this point, thinking that they qualify. And even the classification African-American, you hear stories sometimes where people will tell me, maybe apocryphal, maybe not, that their friend from South Africa who's white put down African-American because he said, I'm African and I'm American, or people from Egypt. And some people may really do that, and some people may be trying to game the system. But frankly, if you look at the definitions as Black African-American, if you're a dark-skinned Egyptian, you're officially white. Harvard considers you white. UNC considers you white. But you may think of yourself, well, I'm not white, and I'm from Africa, so I guess African-American fits best. So that just adds to sort of the arbitrariness, is that no one really knows exactly what these, I'm sort of the expert now, but I can tell you, I've talked to people who should be experts who've done civil rights litigation for decades, and they're surprised at some of what they read in my book. So almost no one really knows what these classifications are, and then no one checks. And the funny thing is that Justice Kavanaugh asked the UNC attorney, what do you consider people from the Middle East, Yemen or Egypt and whatnot? And I think he was trying to lead to the point that isn't it arbitrary to call them white and not therefore adding to diversity, and the UNC lawyer claimed not to know. I don't know if he was being strategic or he really didn't, but either way, it just goes to show that it's not obvious to everybody, even at the schools, what the classifications they're using mean.
Another fascinating wrinkle is that we've been in this argument before because, as you write, the Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander category was not originally part of Directive 15 back in 1977, and that was added, as you write in the book, at the behest of Native Hawaiians who were upset when they were applying for colleges in places like California, that they were lumped into the Asian American group, and they said they had a harder time getting into those schools on that basis. I just think it's remarkable that the echo that that has. I mean, this was an argument that was taking place in the 1990s when they were arguing to create this separate Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander category. And it's almost as if here we are, you know, 25 years later and having a similar sort of argument, and everybody has forgotten that this happened in 1995 and 1997.
You can even go back to the 1980s. So that's when I was going to college. And at the time, there weren't nearly as many Asians on the East Coast as there are now. So it wasn't much of an issue with admissions at places like Harvard, but places like Berkeley and Stanford had what could only be called implicit quotas on how many Asian students they were taking. And that was getting quite a bit of controversy even back at that time. And at the time, university officials were actually pretty explicit. Well, we need diversity and we don't want, you know, quote unquote, too many Asians. And there's an article, I don't quote it in the book, but there's an article back from Newsweek in 1988 where a professor at Stanford says, well, you know, if Stanford just took people on merit, it'd be 80% Jews and Asians, and that would create problems. It's not clear what the problems are with that. But it does go back quite a ways. And of course, the Harvard plan, which was endorsed by Justice Lewis Powell in his famous Bakke opinion in 1978, the first major affirmative action case. So, well, Harvard has this plan, they don't have quotas, but they look at the whole applicant. That was originally created not for quote unquote diversity purposes in the benign way we think of it now, but to try to keep down the number of Jews from the Northeast who are getting into Harvard. So there's that echo as well, that the anti-Asian policies that Harvard is pursuing now actually have their roots in anti-Jewish policies from an earlier era.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. We're here with Professor David Bernstein of the George Mason University Law School. Just to underline the legal point that you were making earlier, so the challengers to these Harvard and UNC admissions policies are raising questions under the Equal Protection Clause the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the laws. And the first time that the Supreme Court took up affirmative action, this was in 1978. The case was Regents of the University of California v. Bakke. It ruled that the only compelling interest for affirmative action was classroom diversity. And so the argument about our arbitrariness is that these categories are not fit for that purpose. They are so odd with so many nooks and crannies in them that don't make much sense that it's hard to see how they make sense as a way of ensuring classroom diversity. And it's always hazardous to forecast what the Supreme Court is going to do based on oral arguments, but justices do sort of tip their hand sometimes in their questioning. So what's your view of how the oral arguments in these two cases went?
You know, I think there was an interesting virtual consensus that what Harvard is doing in particular is illegal because Harvard has other mechanisms to try to, even if we assume diversity is a compelling interest, Harvard's other mechanisms where they could achieve a lot more diversity than they would have otherwise without going to race-based admissions. They could get rid of alumni preferences that overwhelmingly favor white applicants. They could get rid of some of the sports recruitment for sports that are largely played at elite private schools where the student body tends not to be diverse in the terms that we're talking about. And I think that in an earlier era, 10, 15, 20 years ago, there might have been some movement towards trying to reach a consensus opinion the way the court actually did in an earlier case called Fisher versus University of Texas. But I think that ship has sailed. And I think the reason, it's both the fact that the court has become more conservative, obviously, but I also think that there's a sense among the justices, the frustration, that look, we've told you explicitly time and time again that you can use race for diversity purposes, but it's a very narrow exception. And you really are supposed to show a compelling interest, or you've really thought about what you're doing, how you're doing it, why you're doing it. Every once in a while, you're supposed to review, see, are there other means that we could do that would allow us to reduce or eliminate the use of race? And that has not happened. What has consistently happened since Bakke in 1978, in not just education, but in other contexts, is that the Supreme Court tells litigants who are the defendants in these cases, you could use race in a limited, narrow way, but it's really disfavored. And then the defendants at issue, whether they be universities, state governments, or whoever, say, oh, the Supreme Court has said we could do whatever we want so long as we don't explicitly say we're using quotas. And at some point, I think you just get frustrated with that as a justice and say, you know, they just keep cheating and we just have to have a much stronger opinion.
Speaking of cheating, though, what do you make of the news in recent days? Top schools are pulling out of the U.S. News and World Report ranking of law schools. I'm thinking particularly of Yale and Harvard. And then in recent days, also the American Bar Association, which accredits law schools, said that it's going to eliminate the requirement that law schools use the LSAT in their admissions. And is it too cynical to view this as a flight from objective metrics, an effort to react to the Supreme Court's likely decision and make admissions and student body decisions so opaque that nobody can second guess what these admissions officers are doing?
Yeah, I not only don't think it's too cynical, I think you've hit the nail on the head. In fact, Yale was the first one to pull out, though it does seem to be coordinated. But one of the things that Dean Heather Gerken said in her letter is that she rejects the use of the LSAT as a rankings measure, although she didn't really explain why. But I thought that was a little odd from an objective point of view, because U.S. News uses all sorts of weird metrics that, you know, you could definitely question spending per student and input rather than output, how many books you have in the library. But LSAT is the one really objective thing where it sort of evens the playing field. You could have gone to an obscure Christian Bible college in Kentucky, or you could have gone to Yale. You both take the same LSAT test and we can compare you one to one. So if the real concern was, you know, we want more equity and more, you know, Dean Gerken is big on bringing in students from lower income backgrounds, this is leveling the playing field. In fact, I was talking to a friend at one of the top five law schools recently before all this happened. He said, you know, U.S. News, while everyone sort of dumps on it in Legal Academy, it has really diversified our class at Chicago. And he didn't mean racial diversity as such. He meant we used to take the kids from Harvard and Yale and Stanford undergrad. And now, because U.S. News makes us focus on the LSAT, we have really expanded the pool of undergraduate institutions that we will take our students from. If they have a 175, which is a very high LSAT score, from a school we've never heard of, we'll still take them. Whereas before, we've said, well, we've never heard of that school. So it's a lot of double talk, really, because it's at cross purposes with what they claim. And I think the end game is, the first, the ABA says, we're not going to require you to use the LSAT anymore. Then top schools say, we're going to pull out of U.S. News in part because they use the LSAT. And then the ABA starts discouraging schools from using the LSAT because they think it interferes with recruiting a so-called diverse class in a racial sense, and essentially not having enough Hispanic and Blacks, especially Black students. And then the law schools say, well, we have to worry about our students passing the bar, and we have to worry about U.S. News. And the ABA, being a very elitist institution, comes back and says, well, if Harvard and Yale and Berkeley and Georgetown are not worried about that, then the worries are obviously not legitimate, and we're going to just basically force you to stop using objective measures. The Supreme Court says you can't use race. We're not going to tell you you have to use race, but we are going to look to see how many students you have of each racial group in your class and threaten your accreditation if you don't have it. And, you know, the University of California, after they tried to repeal the ban on affirmative action by race in California, once that lost, they just abolished the SAT entirely and didn't make it test optional. Now you're not even allowed to submit your SAT. So you're exactly right. I think they're trying to get rid of objective metrics that would allow anyone to show discrimination based on those metrics in the future.
So what is the future of these classifications? As much as we can criticize the Directive 15 groups as arbitrary now, it seems like they're going to be a lot more arbitrary very soon in the future. And if you look at the Pew Research Center data from 2015 on rates of intermarriage, 29% of Asian Americans, 27% of Hispanics, 18% of Black Americans, and 11% of whites are marrying somebody in newlyweds in a different category. And one thing to keep in mind with those numbers is the rates depend on the relative size of the groups. So one Asian American marrying one white American, for example, raises the rate of intermarriage for Asians more than it does for whites. So keep that in mind when you're trying to compare those percentages. But it seems like in 20 or 30 or 50 years, it is going to be really hard to maintain that these classifications make any sense, even if we start from the standing point that they don't make a whole lot of sense now.
Right. And you know, one thing we didn't mention is, while the classifications were invented in the 60s, 70s, I should say, officially, they went back to some government rules in the 50s. And the reason they focused on these particular categories was because they were the visible minorities. Mexican Americans were mostly, you know, brown skinned Black Americans, American Indians, and Asians. They didn't include like Jews and Catholics and Poles and Italians because you couldn't tell just by looking, and it was considered rude, if not illegal, to ask people in those days in the 50s what their race was. So that's why we start focusing on what we call so-called visible minorities. And now, you know, we have sort of aesthetic diversity in higher education. They care about, you know, the brochures for the schools looking like they have a lot of different people. But yeah, what happens though when everybody has at least one Asian, Black, Hispanic, and so forth, grandparent, and everyone can claim these classifications? The classifications themselves don't have any sort of time limit. They don't say you have to be 100% this, or 50%, or 25%. Like the Hispanic classification just says you have to be of Spanish origin or culture. And on the Common App for college admissions, it actually says, how do you identify? So you can identify however you want. I think most people would stop short of engaging in fully fraudulent identity. But again, if you have one ancestor who's of the group, you could legitimately claim membership in that group. And it's not exclusive. You could say you're both white and Black, or both white and Asian, or both Asian and Black. So yeah, it becomes increasingly incoherent, especially in government contracting, where at least in university admissions, they can try to do this in a more finely tuned way. Like right now, African Americans get more affirmative action benefits than Hispanics get, who get about the same as Native Americans, and Asians get sort of a penalty. But in government contracting, every member of an official minority group gets the same benefit for government contracts. And once you have 80 or 90% of the population who is eligible for these benefits, which will happen relatively soon, what is the point anymore? If everyone's getting the benefit, no one is. So that's one point I make in the book, that even if you're in favor of affirmative action, you should be really reconsidering how we classify people, because eventually whatever goals you're trying to accomplish are just not going to be accomplished. It's going to be sort of random that most people get this, but a few people don't, and it's not really clear why that would be.
But the approach that the Biden administration seems to be taking is to kind of solve this problem in the short term by cutting the classifications more finely. They've reopened Directive 15. One of the suggestions that is floating around is to create a new category for Middle Eastern North African descent. And if you were advising a future president who wanted to go in the opposite direction and still held that lodestar ideal of a post-racial America someday, I mean, what kind of policy would you suggest?
The first thing I think I would suggest, and I just really came up in conversation with you before because I hadn't really thought of it previously, is to have an executive order saying that before we have any racial classification, that the agency that wants to use a classification has to show a compelling interest in doing so. Because that's the typical standard for using racial classifications in general under a Supreme Court precedent. So when someone challenges a racial classification, we say the classification has to be justified by a compelling government interest, has to be narrowly tailored. And we should just have a general policy in that regard that we shouldn't have racial classifications unless a compelling interest can be articulated. And the second part of that's important too, and that should be narrowly tailored. We should be saying, okay, once we've identified that compelling interest, is this particular classification, or the way we're classifying people, geared in a narrowly tailored way towards actually achieving the goal? So if we're trying to, for example, if the underlying goal and we decide it's a compelling interest is to help descendants of slaves who have been subject to slavery, Jim Crow, and segregation, help them integrate to the American economy, it doesn't really make sense, for example, to use just being Black or of African descent as a classification, because we have 21% of the Black population of the U.S. as first or second generation immigrants who were not subject to all of that. So why are they included? They tend to benefit disproportionately from university admissions and government contracts and so forth, which seems counter to the original purpose. So one could argue we should just get rid of the classifications in general. And I'm sort of okay with that. But I think the problem is that some of the ways our civil rights laws are structured, it'd be very hard to enforce them without some sort of classification. I don't think we're prepared to get rid of like the Voting Rights Act yet. So either we'd have to overhaul the legislation or we'd have to keep the classifications. But I think if you had this very strong presumption against classifications and had to show the compelling interest and narrow tailoring, that could do a lot to move us away from this.
Thank you, Professor Bernstein. Thank you all for listening. If you found this conversation stimulating, the book again is Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.